use their shit.
Dude, I've got one. I've got
really?
One. I think it's Dude. I think it's a reflective one though. Like it, I oh, think it's okay. like a reflective like I'm triple J that. Sticker. Oh,
fantastic.
Through to you. Can you like yeah that
anyway, we probably should welcome everyone to the Sportscar Safari.
Hang on, before you do that, let me check to make sure we're working.
Yeah, we've had some technical dramas. So we're just gonna check that we're live. We'll continue the small talk. Thank you for joining and signing in, everyone who has joined. And once we've confirmed that you are actually hearing us, we will...
We are live on YouTube.
Fantastic. Welcome, and YouTube.
I will just check.
It's a great way to start.
Oh, look, you know, this mumbling around is the best. That's the way everyone wants to be.
So for those tuning in, I wasn't here for the last podcast, but the boys were live for about 20 minutes before they worked out that they weren't actually live due to a software fault in the very keen to avoid that.
Okay. Confirmed both are working, and just got a message from Wifey saying all good. So she is on the ball. Thank you, Ruth. And we don't have Felix, so it must be working all right.
Maybe it's all Felix. Well, obviously, welcome, Sportscar Safari Podcast. We are joined by Nick Plunk. Welcome, Nick. How are you?
Very, very good. How are you, everyone?
Well, so I guess this is just what should we treat last week as a bit of a sort of a practice, you know, the qualifying, you know, kind of know what you're doing now, and we'll roll into it this time. So.
Yeah, we're all experts now, Andrew.
Yeah, exactly. So what happened, well, I should probably explain what happened last week. We use an online-based web platform for our podcasting, as it enables us to get guests in easily and means that we can easily join from wherever we are in the world at the time. And their servers had a major issue. And basically what we were seeing from our end was as normal, as perfect, but their servers weren't outputting the stream at all and didn't save anything that we were talking about, and basically made a big mess of it. So we're on to their support that night, and just it couldn't happen. It just didn't. They just couldn't reboot or get it going.
We still had a great time.
Yeah, we had a great time. I mean, we had a good chat. I thought it was good. I enjoyed it anyway. I had great fun. Nobody else even heard it.
Well, this is the brilliant thing about the age we're in at the moment, is it's suddenly acceptable for these things to happen. You know, you can be on live television giving the weather or something on the BBC, and if your sort of dog starts yapping in the background, then everyone's kind of attuned to that these days. So, yeah,
anyway. Everyone's a lot more empathetic, and you just need to blame it on COVID.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Actually, you know, I was talking to a few accountant friends and a few other friends, and we were sort of saying that, you know, obviously we don't want to trivialize the matter, but COVID basically has become a giant free kick for anyone. You know, a few accountant mates are sort of saying, like, you know, if you've got a business and you need to write some stuff off and you need to hide some things and you need to get rid of some poor performance in the last possible year, like, now's your free kick to kind of clear the books and hit 2021 on the, you know, if you lose your job, maybe you were shit at your job, but oh no, it's downturn of COVID. I lost my job, you know, like it's a free kick for everyone.
I've heard that before. So there's a fair bit of that going on.
Yeah. So I guess let's start again. Nick, jump in if I'm missing something. People on Instagram at, forgive my pronunciation, Neun Elfers. It's a German for 9/11.
Correct.
Which 964 on the bottom corner of the screen for those on video will probably give it away, the slight Porsche bent. But Nick is probably at the moment, correct me if I'm wrong, probably most well known for not a Porsche, but a Beetle, the Blanc bug. It's a blue, beautiful blue, sort of rally-inspired bug that has been immortalized by Deus Ex Machina in a range of T-shirts and posters, which is very cool. So we'll touch on that. And, just a general car, motorsport, Porsche, photography, cycling kind of guy. So, yeah, it's going to be a great chat. So thanks,
Dave. Beautiful. Looking forward to it.
Why don't you start? What is the Blanc bug?
So the Blanc bug is a 1961 barn find from Queen Bianne in New South Wales. Mm. And it spent its life in that region. So I think the first dealer stamp that was in the books was Tumut. And I actually went through Tumut last year and was thinking about how it was nice to bring it back to that neck of the woods. But yeah, so it was a true barn find. I had the registration sticker on it, which it was last registered before I got it, 1984. Oh, and because it was a country car, for those of you that don't know Queen Beanne, it's near Canberra. And home of Mark Webber, indeed. but it's pretty dry, and I'm not talking about the people there. I'm talking about the weather. Very similar to Adelaide, with no humidity, so a good spot to get a fairly decent car that hasn't been completely rusted. It was in a barn. And one of my good friends is also the mechanic that works on the car, was doing work for a gentleman down in that region, and happened to stumble across the car and got a phone call. And it's funny when you think about, I know most people who will be listening into this has sort of been down this journey before of starting a project and thinking, oh, it'll be easy, I'll just give it a lick of paint and, I'll just replace a few things, and then you have the snowball effect of, justifying to yourself why it deserves a little bit more. Well, I've gone this far, it means I'm going to have to replace every single bolt in the car, and I can't stop there because, then that would just do the whole car a disservice, and you find yourself down that slippery slope of a full nut and bolt restoration.
Yeah. So I guess, and we were touching on this just offline about, stickers on cars, and, I know that the cyclists among you are probably familiar with the rules, the rules of cycling by the Voluminati of the book up here, but we were sort of, Luke and I've been talking about we should do one for cars, race stuff, just certain rules, but because it is, there are lots of Beetles out there and lots of people build Beetles. It's probably the most common, almost arguably the most common platform there is, but yours looks different, and it's down to just the small details and the taste. So where were your inspirations for this car? Because it's, I think it's definitely one where the sum is greater than the whole.
You're quite right there. It is about the details, and I am a details guy, and I think that you need to be have that view to build something special. It needs to be attention to detail, so that's agreed. The inspiration for the car, mainly there were a couple of cars that I'd seen over the net, over the years, which I wanted to use as inspiration. So one of them was actually an Australian car, which was built in the, I think it was the late 90s, for Tiger Tasmania. And that was the Jeff Harding car, which competed in Targa in that late 90s, early 2000s period. So did I lose you guys there, or
no,
all good?
We're all good. All good. It's just me mucking around.
Okay. So that car was a same age, I think pretty much the same colour or very similar colour palette, and it was a rally, a true rally car. It was built to compete in Targa Tasmania. So it had to follow the rule book of, meeting the classes, etc. So that was one car. And how I came about getting inspired by that car. Sorry, Luke.
Yeah, that's right. I just saw a picture of it. I was just trying to bring it up.
So that car, I was actually thinking of buying it, and I was unsuccessful in buying it. So then I thought, all right, well, I'm going to go out and build my own. So that was, one of the cars. And there's another car in Oregon in the States, which is a historic race car, which is of a similar, it's called Gilbert the Race Bug. And you always need a great name with a car like that. And that was also in a historic race car that still does the rounds. And that's a Rod or a Gary Emery built car.
Very cool.
So it's been built right. And Steve and the owner also has 356s. And but yeah, he gets out there and competes quite regularly in that historic race scene. But yeah. The overall theme of the car, though, was very much a European-inspired rally car. So think of, you know, something that would potentially compete in the early days of the Monte Carlo rally, you know, how something would have been looked if it was a factory-entered car in the early 60s. So that was the overarching theme that I was trying to build. But nice. there was a limit. I did sway a little bit. So in that build, there's things like, you know, the seats. So I decided to go a non-period correct seat, which was a Recaro pole position seat, for safety. But the way that I kind of got around that was using Porsche Pepita, you know, fabric in the centre of the seat. So, you know, I just was able to do little things like that to get away with trying to make the car as period correct as possible.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we drove that Monte Carlo FJ.
Yeah.
That was like 100% period done.
Yeah.
And there's definitely needs to be some allowances for like upgrading things like seats, because they had like the bench seats in that still too, and that was horrid to try and drive.
Yeah. If you're gonna actually enjoy horrible. The car, you need to do those things. So yeah, and what's it running?
Give you leeway for that.
Mechanically, you've got those Techno Magnesia wheels, but what's under the?
Good eye.
I'm gonna lie. I read it.
So it's funny, you know, you talk about or I talked about the starting a project and thinking that I wasn't going to go that far, and in chatting with a good mate of mine who helped build the car with me, Trent Demos, we originally saw those wheels and then we saw the price of the wheels and we went nuts. Or rather, I went, no, it's not going to happen. So those wheels are made in Italy for a 356, and they're a magnesium alloy, and they're designed to look like a steel wheel. So to the untrained eye, you know, you don't take a second look at it because it's just a steely. And it's the wide five pattern. So, yeah, it's just a steel wheel to anyone who doesn't know. But get up close, and it's a fantastic looking magnesium alloy wheel, which is just, you know, that's one of my favorite things on the car is the wheels, because no one expects to see a wheel like that on a Beetle. You know, they were designed, those wheels were designed to be sitting on a Porsche 356. So I won't tell you how much they cost, but, you know, it's just one of those things that...
do it once, do it right.
Do it once and do it right. And I've had to undo a few things for not following that ethos. And, it's one of those rules that it does bite you if you don't do it. But running gear-wise, on behind those wheels is actually a full vented and cross-drilled four-wheel disc brake system. So it's a hidden system made to look like a drum brake, but it absolutely, you know, pulls up and does a great job. So the rest of the running gear is it's all still Beetle, so Type 1 air-cooled. I originally was going down the path of using the motor, which was the 1200 motor, and boring it out. So I did a few things, which was there's a tuning company for Volkswagens in the late 50s, which is Okrasa. Okrasa turned into Oettinger, which is still around today, is the one of the main Volkswagen tuning companies. So that's where its origins come from. and I went out and sourced one of their, all of their engine components. So it was the very first hot rod company for VW. So it was a special 69.5 millimeter crankshaft, a counterweighted crankshaft. It was dual port heads, and it was twin Solex carbies. So it was just little things like that, which you know, doubled the horsepower of a. Let's be honest, it's only started its life as a 40 horsepower engine. So even when you double it, yeah, you're not getting big numbers out of it. But
always percentages. Percentages.
Exactly. Exactly.
200% more horsepower.
So now I'm actually building pretty much an all-out engine, which I'm in the process of doing with Trent, who I referenced earlier. So Trent's going, and we're doing this in our spare time, and that's a 1914cc Volkswagen engine based off a 1600. So 1600. Was the largest capacity of the Type 1 engine that there was ever done any development on. So you can still buy those cases brand new, fly Brazil, and, yeah, it's pretty cheap to go out and buy it. So there's a tuning company in Sweden, of all places, which is continuing to advance the doing R&D and raising the bar on what's possible with a Volkswagen engine. So his company is called JPM, and I spoke to him last year, and he's now gone and specced me up an engine that he shipped over, and we're assembling here locally. So I've got a really big timber crate delivered to home, and we're piecing it all together. So it's like building Lego, but a bit more complex. Yeah, that's the latest incarnation of the engine, and I'm having so much fun with this car that it's one of those projects that I'm forever happy to be tinkering with it, because it's a lifer for me, this car. So we'll see how far we can evolve it.
Awesome. Nick, how far did you sway from the original design idea? Has it stayed pretty true to what was originally in your head?
It has body-wise. I actually had some concept drawings drawn up by another mate of mine, which was, you know, what we wanted to do with the build. So we had a plan, and it was sitting on the panel beater's shop wall as he was building it. So that was the end goal. So it was the only thing that swayed from it was actually a white stripe going down the middle with which didn't, I didn't think the car needed it in the end with the large meatballs, you know. And that's that fine art of learning when to stop. You know, sometimes you can't control.
Otherwise, you'll end up full Mustang or something with like badges and stripes everywhere.
Exactly. But the inspiration for the white stripes for Beetle came from the very first Okrasa Beetles in 1964, yeah, which did actually have a white stripe, and they're as rare as hen's teeth. And not many people know this, but Volkswagen actually had a big thing of not being involved in motorsport. It wanted to be the people's car, and it was a transportation. It was, motorsport was definitely not on their radar, and they definitely went out of their way actually to stop it. So that happened in the US with the MP tuning company. So MP was the first of the major tuners in the US, and it happened with the Okrasa Beetle. So I think the number is around 50 of these hotted up Beetles were built before the big cheeses at Volkswagen got wind of it. And these are obviously in the days before Instagram, where you could flash things up straight away, but it obviously took a while for them to cotton on to what the it was the Belgian importer of Volkswagen was doing. They had a hotted up tuning division on the side, and they built these cars, which are fantastic if you can track one down.
But no, very cool. So how and I guess one thing I'm really interested to know, people are out, you know, they've got your car hanging on their wall, Deus posters, they're wearing it on their shirts. How did that happen? Is that sort of the ultimate, sort of hat tip of, you know, your car's cool if Deus sort of taps you on the shoulder and says, let's put it on a t-shirt? Is that?
I like to think so. but it's a pretty humbling and also cool thing to go through when you, for me, it was the moment seeing it, because they did a kids range as well, so which was the really cool part. It was seeing, I saw this young boy would have been maybe, you know, eight years old, you know, walking down the street wearing, you know, my t-shirt, and that was a pretty cool moment. And you know, it's the same also when I'm driving the car. I get the most joy out of it when I see young kids look at the car and all they do is smile. They don't know what a Volkswagen Beetle is because they're not common on the road anymore. It was different times to when, you know, I grew up. Beetles were pretty common sight. But yeah, seeing a Beetle drive down the street and an air-cooled one is definitely a rare sight in Sydney these days. So just seeing a kid who, you know, is young, just looks at it and smiles, you know, that's pretty cool for me. But I get a lot of pleasure out of that. Going back to how it all sort of came about, the very first car that you had up on the screen, which was my 964, it was actually, that car was actually Carby Tuckwell's car. So Carby is one of the founders of Deus, and him and Dare started the company in the mid-2000s. So, I bought that car from Carby in 2010. That's where we sort of found each other. Now bringing cycling into this as well, so we can tick all of the boxes. I purchased one of Deus's very first bike releases when they were doing the reproduction and repurposing old steel frames, and I bought one of their. I saw it. For those of you who in sort of Australia who read the AFR, the AFR has a Friday pull-out section, which is called, I think, something along the lines of Life and Luxury or something like that. And this Deus bike was one of their features, and it was one of their push bikes, was one of their features, and they were still a relatively young brand here in Sydney, but they still had that cool factor. And I saw it, and the reason why it caught my eye was it was the Golf racing colours. So it was a Golf blue painted steel frame, and they were all vintage frames. I think that one was a Speedwell frame. And it had bright orange Velocity wheels, which are deep dish Aussie made wheels, and it was a single speed, and it really caught my eye. So I went in and actually bought that bike, and that was, I think, maybe in 2006 or 2007. So it was one of their very first builds. So I've had a great sort of association with the brand. It looked a lot like that.
That's not the one.
Yeah, it was more of a Golf blue. I've still got that bike today.
Awesome.
But, yeah, I've just had a great association with the brand and, developed developed a great friendship with Carby over the years. So it's just sort of worked well together. And Carby knew what I was doing with building the Beetle. So, yeah, we just got talking and, yeah, the next thing we knew, we were he was taking it was actually Thomas Walk who took the photos, which Carby then drew. And for those of you that don't know, Carby does do those drawings by hand. So he's got a huge talent.
They're not like an Illustrator or Photoshop filter. They are drawn.
Exactly. So, you know, I've got some of Carby's artwork over there, and I've got lots of his posters
scattered around. His work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's cool. Done the Defender range. He's done Matt Hart's Barracuda.
I've got that shirt. Yeah.
He's done some great cars. He's done a really good Alpha 105, which was a recent one, which you should get if you don't have an Android, being an Alpha guy as well.
Yep.
Yeah. So
it's actually quite sad. I think, was it Mum bought myself and Dad matching ones or something like that? Sad. It's almost as bad as like Ferrari family stuff where everyone's wearing red Puma stuff.
We can touch on that. Exactly. But I've got in the cupboard some kid sizes for when Baxter, my son, is old enough to get into them. So the good thing is that with something like that is that it's always in fashion because it's already a vintage product that you're wearing. So if he puts it on in 5 years' time or whatever, it'll still be, you know, all the rage.
There'll be that sweet spot between when he thinks Dad is cool because he's got his car on the shirt, and then he'll get to that age where he won't want to be seen in it because Dad's car's on the shirt. So, like,
He's able to drive that car in the window.
Well, there's a funny story about that around, you know, my dad's car is cool or it's not cool. My daughter, who's 15, still gets in the Beetle with me today. So I do, you know, school drop-offs. And when I picked her up, I think it might have been late last year from school after she was doing a drama play, she was waiting outside where I asked her to wait, and she had some of her fellow actors with her and classmates. And she heard my car coming, and I'm thinking she's probably, you know, going, oh, God, here comes Dad in the Beetle. But she happened to overhear some of the older boys going, oh, my God, that's so cool. And that quickly changed her tune to when she said, see you guys, I'm out of here, that's my dad, and hopped in the bargain and drove off. So, there is always that fine line of 1 minute you're cool and the next you're not in life.
But I guess, touching on that, like, the shirts are a forever type of thing, I think a lot of the stuff that Deus does is really quite timeless. Like, it's not... The brand itself and what they do doesn't seem to be stuck in a time. Like, you know, Carby's artwork and what he does is like a really, really quite timeless stuff. Like it will be cool forever, I think.
I think the ultimate
hat. Yeah, I hope so.
Style is that he's being imitated by a lot of people. And I think, you know, imitation is a serious form of flattery, and when you start getting, you know, I mean, even I noticed, you know, we're massive fans of you know, the Spikes Car Radio podcast, but they did a shirt recently which basically could have been drawn by Carby, and you sort of, that's the I think that's the ultimate, you know,
level of influence from him.
Did some he did all of the early artwork for Luftigl as well, so
I think I've got the poster right there behind me.
I did see that. I saw that in the background. You know, so he has done some amazing work. But as you said, there are lots of people now who are, you know, I'll use the word imitating, you know, but it's pretty hard not to get inspired by people, you know, in the scene. Yeah, and influence. So it is one of those tricky things where, some people get their noses out of joint and go, you know, that's, you know, too close. But there is that fine line, which is sometimes sort of easy to cross.
But I think that's kind of what art is, you know. I mean, not that I profess to know a lot about art or music or anything, but I mean, musicians and artists, is what they do is, I think that, you know, they get all of these influences from all of these places, and then they add their own sort of spin, and then add their little bit and kind of further the cause a little bit further, and then someone else takes it, and I guess you just get this sort of style that evolves out of time. But so it's not necessarily complete copying, but yeah.
Exactly. You look at sampling in music, and you know, I've been tricked over the years where, you know, I've thought something was an original song with, you know, which was, I didn't realize it was a sample, but it was something that had stolen, you know, from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, what have you. But it's being able to put your own spin on it and making it good, which is the art form, which if you don't have creative talent, you'll never be able to execute just, you know, that last mile.
Mm. Exactly. So
yeah, well, I mean, like, that happens with us with photography. You know, you see something you like and you go, I wonder how they did that, and, you know, how you know, what settings they had, what lighting they used, and, you know, you do find yourself mimicking those files. I mean, did everyone go through a Ted Gushue phase of trying Flash? I don't think anyone worked out what Ted did.
But you know, just think about that. You have a look at the old photos of what photographers did in the 50s and 60s and 70s. Mm. You know, obviously those eras were only film, but, you know, how the lying down shot, you know, where they're lying underneath the barriers getting that distance shot. You know, that's obviously still used today, but, you know, a lot of people would realise that, you know, photographers were obviously doing that, you know, back then. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's very hard to say, you know, well, I invented a look, or this is my look, because everyone does get, you know, inspiration from someone else. And, you know, I look at what Ted's doing today, which is some fantastic work. And, you know, he's getting some fantastic exposure. But, you know, you can also see where, you know, a lot of his influences have come from, you know, over the years. You know, if you look at Slim Aarons and...
I was going to say Slim Aarons.
You know, like it's just not that he's going out to copying everyone, but everyone gets inspiration from, you know, what you like. And what you see every day. And, you know, being a photographer is, you know, viewing everything like that, and that's your world. So, it's just great to be able to put your own spin on it.
What are you, I guess we're on the photography train now, change subjects a little, but what are you shooting at the moment?
I'm actually a frustrated photographer at the moment. My camera gear is all sitting there gathering dust. I'm a frustrated Sony user. I'll tell you the funny story how I ended up getting poisoned. I was approached probably 2 years ago now by Leica Australia. To do some work for them, and with that came this wonderful gift of around $40,000 worth of brand new camera equipment. So
one camera and a lens.
it was two cameras. So it was an SL2 and some fantastic lenses for that. And the one of the M series, the M10P, and that really killed it for me. It was like a drug dealer, you know, saying, "Here, have your first hit. It's on the house."
Getting there going, we got a laugh on customer now.
Exactly. But through going through that experience, I had to relearn photography. And it's only something that viewfinder and Leica shooters can really sort of understand. That you have to think about how you take a shot using a rangefinder, and it's not spray and pray. You've really got to think about what you're focusing on, the depth, etc. So that for me, and I'd like to think that I'll be able to afford some Leica gear at some stage in my life, but it really took the fun out of my Sony gear, because I was forever wanting the Leica camera back. So it was a bittersweet experience.
It's almost like the first time you drive a proper car, you drive a GT3 or something really special, and you've grown up on a diet of, sort of affordable stuff, and then you drive something proper and you go, oh, I get it now. Like, yeah, this is what a car can be. And you jump back in your old Alfa and you're like, sort of once you've experienced it, it's very, very tough to go back. But I don't know, I've never shot with Leica, so, I'm probably talking crap, but the bit about slowing down, I've definitely found I shoot digital for work. So I sort of started noticing that when we go away on holidays and when we travel, I didn't want to shoot because it just felt like work. And then you'd have all these photos to process when you get home, and it was just turning into work. So I got myself, our friend Bryce was over, and we went out and 75 pounds and bought a 35 millimeter film, little Nikon matte sort of film camera, which is just there. And yeah, it cost 70 quid. So it's not, what's that, $130. So it's not expensive at all. And we'd go away to Spain for 2 or 3 days and I'd have 36 photos. That's all I've got. And so every time I take it everywhere, but you're looking for things and you're going, is that a good photo? No, it's not. You're thinking about it. And then you sit down and you're like, okay, what can I do? How can I do this? And then the really weird thing is I'd found that when I travel with my digital camera, I'd come home with 300, 400 photos and I'd sift through them and I'd end up with 20 that I really liked. And those are the ones that I'd share. And on the film camera, I would basically come home with 20 or 30 keepers. Like, the ratio was the same, even though I was only taking 36 photos, I'd end up with the same number of keepers. It was really bizarre. And so now, for me, whenever, we just spent a week away down in Cornwall and I took the film because I was like, I actually just really enjoy the process of slowing down. And
I've got the solution for you. 16 or like 32 megabyte SD cards. They're like four photos. Go back in time. Don't need a 64 gig or 120 gig. Nah, get a 64 megabyte. You'll be fine.
But Andrew, if you do get the chance to get the a Leica camera, I would highly, highly recommend it. It's just an experience. It's driving something that's very unique and nothing like it. And during that process of me, shooting that camera, I did quite a few exciting trips around the place, and I was in, and it's like you've joined a cult club. I was in Queenstown, and I was using that camera, and I had a Leica ambassador who was wearing his little red pin. come up and talk to me, and he introduced himself. We had a special handshake, which I'm not allowed to share what it is.
really?
And
there could be.
there well could be. But he saw the camera that I had and he knew it was one of the newer models. And, we got talking and, he gave me a few tips on how to use it. And my wife was there with us and she was watching, the hours tick by going, is this going to carry on for much longer? Whilst we were gas-bagging about how wonderful Leica cameras are. That is the wonderful world of Leica. And I'll finish on the part which was really special for me. At the end of that experience of handing all of that camera gear back, my dad actually gave to me his Leica camera from the 70s and his father's Leica camera from the 50s. It's the kind of thing that you can pass on, and that's the part which I've never really thought of before. When you buy a Sony, a Canon, a Nikon, a Fujifilm camera, you get in that treadmill of there's a new model out, I need to upgrade it, and that's a slippery treadmill that you go down. Whereas when you're in that Leica world, it's a little bit like a Rolex watch where when it starts to age, you get a little bit more street cred. It's not new anymore. And that's something which also I really think is very much a Leica thing, because, yes, it's expensive and, it's eye-wateringly expensive. But if you think about it in the context of potentially you can have that for, 40 years and pass it on to another generation, it becomes inexpensive.
And the other thing, I remember watching a Q&A with Ted, and this bit sort of struck me, and someone asked him, are the photos any different from a Leica? And he sort of the answer was like, well, yeah, they are, but they're not worlds better. But he said, I remember him saying that, like, having the Leica grants you access, he said it gets a different reaction out of people, and it grants you an access to areas that, if you'd gone in with a big sort of, I mean, I've got a Nikon D4, which is the size of a truck, it's massive.
Walking around with an iPad.
Like you walk into a place with a big, you look like a war photographer, like a war photojournalist, walking in, and you get that sort of reaction. But if you walk in with a small, compact, high quality sort of mechanical, beautiful thing, you definitely am, and the type of photos you can then get and the reactions you get from people are a whole different style. So that was his answer, that so yes, the photos are very different, but because of that reason. So, yeah, interesting to hear.
Yeah, I tend to agree. Definitely.
100%. But did you catch Larry Chen's story on Instagram the other day with the machine gun thing?
Yeah. Well, actually,
like being deliberate with like taking your photos.
Well, that's the other end of the
story. It was like 800 frames like in 2 seconds. It was crazy.
Yeah. But I mean, look, at the end.
Was anything in like a... Was he at Pikes Peak?
Pikes Peak, yeah. Which you kind of have to, I guess.
Yeah. And in those contexts.
Strapped to a helicopter as well.
So
it would be cool.
Yeah. So do you still have the 964, Nick, or has that gone?
No, I sold the 964 last year, and I pretty much, did everything I wanted to do with it. As far as giving it a little bit of a unique look, it was very much for me an RS inspired build. So I used all genuine RS parts. You can see in that photo there, it's got the rear bar of an RS. It's got the rear screen of an RS, but I never took it too far by putting an RS badge on it. Because that's, we talked earlier around crossing the line. That's crossing the line too far, because it's not an RS.
So you're not a BMW owner then?
Definitely not. I've passed that car on to another ex-Adelaidean boy up here in Sydney, Josh. So he's enjoying that car now, and he sends me the odd snap of it every now and then to show that he's still looking after it. And that's really what, being a sort of an owner or a guardian of a product like that allows you to do. You own it for a piece of time. you try not to destroy it. So no RWB.
Speaking of going too far.
Getting the can opener.
Yeah.
So I was just going to say that car I took to Targa Tasmania in that livery there, and we had a hell of a lot of fun with it, and that was I've got very fond memories of it, but I was also happy to let it go as well.
Yeah.
Mm. So I guess there's a bit of rear engine German stuff there. What else have you had? Have you had anything else interesting or noteworthy? Or
yes, there's a 964 Club Sport, which I also did Targa Tasmania in.
Yep.
Which I think from memory, I had the same livery on that as well. Yep. So I wanted to sort of do back to back with. That same look, and that was, you know, talking of, you know, rear engined air cooled to the 964, which is you know, the most balanced car that Porsche's, you know, ever produced. So it's an equal 50-50 weight distribution. It was an absolute blast to drive. So a very different beast to a 964. But I describe the driving of a 968 as being compliant and competent, and you knew what it was going to do. It was the kind of car that never bit you. Whereas, you know, a 964 or any of the rear engine two-wheel drive Porsche models, you know, if you were to go around the corner and, you know, it was a little bit slipperier than the previous corner, it would be very easy to lose the rear end, whereas, you know, you just didn't get that experience in the 968. So it was, a real fun car to drive. So I had that for a couple of years, and then moved it on just due to sort of lack of use. And that's sort of been the way that I some cars are keepers, and it's the same with, I guess, a lot of people that are in the car scene. There's some that they're happy to pass on and some that are real keepers. Some of the other stuff, I imported a Superbug, which is a 1303S from the UK. It was a Japanese car, so it was a Japanese car that went to the UK. I bought it out of the UK and imported it into Australia. And that car I also had for a couple of years, and I did my look of playing around with that. I can't handle things when they're standard. I need to do a little bit of creative outlet with it. So I'm a big believer of vinyl, as you can see. You know, vinyl's fantastic. You can apply it, you can rip it off when you're sick of it, and you know, you haven't really damaged the car. So the Superbug that I had, I did a black bonnet and a black deck lid.
Nice.
And I did the Austrian flag as stripes over the car, and I did some big CB headlights, some oversized CB headlights. Nice. So once again, went for that look of the rally inspired cars. That's the car.
That's a different car. I thought that was pretty, an early iteration of the Blunkbug. It's a different car.
No. Andrew, look at the indicator on the top of the thing.
All the Volkswagen people are probably tearing their hair out.
What do you mean you don't know it's a different car?
It's the same with the Beetle, aren't they all the same?
No, we're going to get all the hate mail now.
I was joking.
Yeah. So that. that car was inspired, and we talked earlier about, you know, what inspires and try not to copy too much, but that car was inspired by the factory Volkswagen Porsche Austria rally team, which was a rally team that was put together in Austria, factory backing, and it was a joint development between Porsche and Volkswagen. And yes, funnily enough, they did use a Volkswagen rather than a Porsche. But they started it in 1971, 72, 73 in what was the World Rally Championship at the time. And they did actually, I believe they either they won some events or placed on the podium. So it was quite an interesting concept that had its brakes put on it, as in the concept got stopped in the oil crisis of 1973, and that pulled it apart, and therefore there was no further development on those particular cars.
That's a really interesting footnote, because that was peak 911R, peak, you know, Porsche at the sort of the height of their rally powers, and to sort of shun all of that and go the other direction is a an interesting little
they were still doing it with the 911 range, but this would have been, you know, a quirky side project for them, and this was at the very end of the development with the Beetle, so you know, they were probably working out what to do next with the brand. Now, for those of you that don't know, the 1303, which was called the L-Bug in Australia, was the very last of the development on that Volkswagen Type 1 platform. So you've got things like an aerodynamic windscreen, which means you can see there's a curving of the windscreen there, which was an amazing concept, whereas all Beetles prior to that actually had a flat windscreen. They had a plastic dashboard, which looked like a proper dashboard, whereas my early Beetles, you know, they have a metal dashboard, which is painted the colour of the car.
All those little
you know, creature comforts that you know you get were big things back in the day, and that was that all
things
came
to
about
stop your
from
face getting
pretty much
when you have a crash.
Exactly that. It was US crash testing, which brought in all of those. And but if you think about it, this was pretty much pre-seatbelt, so you did actually hit your face on the dashboard, whereas today you've got to have a pretty serious accident to get your face on the dashboard. Look at that beard I had back then. That was a pretty serious
beard.
Oh, is
that you? I didn't even we're discussing ISO haircuts or lack of earlier.
Or lack of.
Jeez, I hope you got a contract with Gillette or something. I don't know. That's pretty cool. Oh yeah, look at that.
Yeah. So there's the beard. So it's all happening.
Beautiful.
Some of the guys.
Go on, sorry.
No, sorry. I was just saying that the previous photos are some of one of the guys who built the car. That's DJ from the toy shop. Gerard Needham, who's also a big Instagrammer.
Gerard, yeah.
Nine something. They're all had a little bit to play in that car. And that's been, I guess, the best thing about, you know, building a car like that, and this is the same for building any car, is, you know, the involvement and the friendships that, you build, you know, along the way is just been, you know, absolutely memorable. That's Fritz, my engine builder. So Fritz is the guy who actually found the car in Queanbeyan. That's him playing with the engine. So, cool. Everyone sort of – and I still speak to all of these guys, you know, on a weekly basis, and, you know, we're sort of itching for the, you know, what's next, you know, what's the next project.
What is the next project?
Oh, there's the thing. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, the drawing.
Yeah, that's the concept drawing, which, as I said, was on the wall of the shop. So yeah, that's still there. What's next? Well, in this world of pretty crazy prices for air-cooled Porsches, you know, I've still got a dream to build an early bumper car. So, you know, pre-73 or pre-74. Mm-hmm. So that's still on the to-do list. And I've got a lot of ideas in my head as to, you know, how to build, you know, the right car for that. I don't have the funds at the moment to put that together. So I might dabble with another Beetle. And I'm really liking the later era. So the later era is that sort of 73, 74, 75 era.
You're great. It was
for a moment there. It's gonna be like, okay.
No. not going that far. But there's a different look, which is very heavily European influenced, and you do get it in the UK, which is called the German look. A German look Beetle is a car that came together as a 1990s build. So Googling this, Kafer Cup. Kafer Cup.
Yep.
Kafer Cup was a racing series that they did early to mid-90s.
Kafer Cup.
Yeah, that thing there. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I can see where you're going with that.
Oh, wow. Oh, look. Yeah. Man, what is that thing?
Yeah, the Beetle. So, they still run the Cup over here.
The second car in, amazing. And the fun car are imitation cars. I think they're just shells, which have got different engines in them. But that second one there, the silver car, if you want to, that car is absolutely insane. It's got air jacks. I think it's got a sequential gearbox. It's got everything. It's pretty much a full carbon body. So that's the kind of build I think I'll get some ideas for to turn that into a street car. Now I'll caveat with the strict instructions from my wife, Emma. On my
no sequential
build
gearboxes
is for God's sake, let it have a rear seat because all of my cars have tended to have no rear seats because I've been hell bent on weight saving. You know, you're a family man. let's do something with the family and have a rear seat. So,
well, Frisco's
going to work out a way
to
do a roll cage
that,
and a rear seat.
Yeah.
Roll cage and rear seat. Yeah, how'd you
gentlemen,
do that?
I'm sorry to interrupt. I need to call time on myself. If you guys would like to continue the podcast, please do. I have a hard deadline. I'm sorry, so I do need to.
That's all good.
Well, I don't know, Nick. Do you feel like there's more you want to go through, or like?
I'm happy to talk. You can see I'm really struggling here, so
yeah.
I'm happy to call it. Or I'm happy to talk for a little bit longer. So,
Luke, I'll leave it up to you. I'm sorry to call time, but we do fit Sports Car Safari around our lives, and occasionally we come up with a hard deadline. So I do apologise.
Absolutely.
All good.
Have fun.
I will.
Thank you, Andrew. Good to see you.
We'll see you next week. Nick, thank you very
Andrew.
Much. I'll tune in on my out now. I'll watch the rest of it.
Yeah, listen in live on your way.
See you, mate.
Yeah, awesome. So, Nick, have you owned anything that's not air cooled? And not Porsche?
Yes. But I'm pretty heavily bent in the VAG group. So
awesome.
I've just sold an RS4. I've been a big sort of wagon guy over the years as a family car. I never thought I'd do this, but I've actually bought my first SUV. So SQ7 is the new family truck that we'll be getting in a couple of weeks. So actually looking forward to that. So that's a 4-liter V8 turbo diesel. It's a triple turbo because you need triple these days. 900 newton meters of torque. I did actually justify that as well by going, well, I can actually tow cars on that and I'll be able to do a little bit more of things like, you know, getting down to Adelaide for some events. My wife's family is still in Adelaide, so that's how we get down to that sort of neck of the woods.
Yeah, it would make the drive a lot more pleasant and probably feel a bit more refreshed coming up, being able to overtake trucks with ease in super comfort.
Exactly. What else has there been? I've got a Golf GTI Club Sport manual at the moment, which is the daily drive. There's been Mini Cooper S's. There's been 996 C4S Porsche. 964 C2 Cabriolet, which was my very first Porsche about sort of 15 or longer years ago. So it's been sort of very heavily based and biased on the German car scene for me. And that comes from, you know, growing up in, my dad's German and I've grown up in pretty much a German car family.
That's when those when your love of cars is formed when you're younger and you know you have exposure to a certain brand. On you know, for me it was dad always had Alphas, and you know, we had Alphas as a kid, and you know, I remember playing around in his 105 in the backyard when I was a little boy because it was off the road at the time, and that's what's kind of forged my love of Italian cars. So I guess, like, were you carted around in a Beetle or?
Yes, I grew up in a Beetle and a Type 3, which is the station wagon. I actually inherited that car from my parents when I got my license, and that was my very first build. So I did that as a 18, 19 year old. That car was a magazine car at the time. And it's funnily enough, running around today. So pretty much looking how I built it back then. So, yeah.
What era was that?
That was a 1970 1500 Volkswagen Beetle.
That was
the look back then. The look was very much I didn't want to make it a Cal look, which is an American inspired Beetle, but I
like the real rakey kind of ones that
I didn't do that.
Drop spindles at the front and back all
correct
up. Yeah,
correct. But I did and this is obviously, you know, what my future destiny was really to get a Porsche. I've tried to throw as many Porsche parts on that Beetle as I could afford and what would fit. So it had 16-inch genuine Fuchs. And it had Porsche mirrors. It had all sorts. It had Recaro A8 seats, which were amazing back in the day. That was in the 90s, and they were the seats to have. It had a Porsche designed Momo steering wheel. And believe it or not, it had a RSR tacho, so a 10,000 RPM genuine Porsche tacho, which if I had that today, I believe you can sell them for you know, a few grand just for a tachometer. But yeah, it had all those sort of crazy parts on it. But yeah, yeah. As I said, that car is still running around today, and I actually tried to buy it a couple of years ago. And everything always comes down to timing. I just finished the blog bug, and and then my old car came on the scene, and I was like, do I really need two Beetles? It was just really poor timing, and I was like, well, if I can get it for a bargain, I'll pick it up. And it just didn't stay on the market for long. And before I had a chance to make a decision on it, the decision was made, you know, someone else picked it up.
Well, I guess that's also kind of a nice thing, because, you know, you can focus on the blog bug and kind of pushes you down that path, because otherwise you could probably become a bit stretched and gone between the two. One would just be left sitting there, I feel like.
Exactly. And it was one of those things where the only reason why I would have picked it up was because it was actually my mum bought the car brand new. So it wasn't just a car that I, you know, built. It was a car that my mum bought brand new, I grew up in, and then I modified it myself. So it was those things that were, because I'm not normally, you know, that nostalgic around, you know, previous cars that I've had. But, yeah, this one sort of fell into a pretty special category.
Yeah, that's that, like, whole defining, you know, interests in life kind of moment car.
Exactly. Really,
which is pretty crazy. I mean, Andrew and I are both very similar. We've both got our first cars still. You know, Andrew's got his X19. I've got my 124 that I that Nornor bought, and I remember as a little boy him teaching me how to drive manual and it sitting next to him, and, you know, all those types of things. They're cars that if you manage to hold on to them are a pretty special thing to have. You know, it's that,
exactly,
like a Rolex-y hand-me-down generation-y type thing, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. Do you still drive it?
No, it's currently a shell sitting next to me.
Uh-huh.
I've actually got two now, because as they do, they multiply. I'll just spin the camera. You can actually see they're sitting in my shed at the moment, and it is. So I've got two 124s there. So one's got a few bits of leftover that I need to go and do and everything like that. Yeah. So they're just sitting there. You know, we've just shifted house and been renovating the shed, ready to turn it into a decent workshop so that we can.
Very cool. So are they sitting in primer, or are they actually painted?
No, they're painted, but still rust everywhere. So I learned a lot of great things from my Nornor, and like mechanical things. He was a fitter turner by trade, and all of my mechanical knowledge and aptitude has come from him, and but bodywork, no. So he did the bodywork himself, and it's like there's a big underground, like a big boring drilling company that he used to work for. So there's that, you know, that Tupac white was painted in that, so it's like, you know, thick kind of crazy stuff, but underneath that's all bog and rust. So there's a fair bit of work there. I kind of shift it a little bit. You can't really see. Hence the English wheel there to try and help create some panels and rust repair sections and things like that. So,
yeah, fair
bit of work to go with that. So, yeah, you know, shed's kind of finished. I can almost get cracking on that soon, which would be cool. Looking forward to get that back on the road and, you know, sharing that same as it was shared with me with my kids, and, you know, help growing that passion for cars down the generations.
Yeah. And that's what makes it cool, is as we become parents, you kind of work that out and you understand it. It's just about, you know, experiences and memories for life.
Yeah. Like, I remember when I was a kid, I always had cars there, but like there was a period of time when I was growing up where, you know, there was basketball, there was sport, there was school, there was computer games, there was other things that, like, I didn't want to necessarily go out and watch a race meet when I was like 13 years old and stuff like that. But because I had those pivotal moments, you know, when I was a young kid, you know, being in Adelaide, being able to go to the F1 and
It's very accessible.
Yeah, accessible stuff. Having Classic Adelaide Rally was floating around. You know, there's all of those types of influences. So that's what I keep doing with my kids is just, you know, come down the shed, see the cars, come out to an event, see a car. If you don't like it, that's great. But, you know, hoping that they'll catch on and continue with it, which is pretty cool.
Indeed.
Yeah, and I guess that's the same purpose that you have with the Beetle too, that serves with your kids as well, getting that reaction and that smile and that passion out of them.
Oh, my wife has taken some videos of Baxter, my son, sitting on my lap whilst I've you know, driven the car down the driveway, and you know, they're absolutely priceless. Yeah. You know, the sheer pleasure of, he would have been three at the time, the sheer pleasure of watching, you know, something like that being played back to you, that kind of smile, you can't make it up. And, yeah, it's pretty cool when you see something like that, you know, play out. So just being able to have those kinds of experiences is what is, you know, very special as a parent. But that could be, you know, that could come from, you know, anything that's that you're interested in and doing, you know, with your children. It doesn't only come from cars, but it's just about being able to do that and experience it with, you know, all the people that, you know, make up your family.
Yeah, it was actually interesting hearing you speak about, like, getting generational Leicas and then getting generational Beetles and just how that's influenced you in your life now. Yeah, similar experience. Like, I remember being at the Avalon Air Show when I was a younger kid and shooting photos with Dad's Olympus OM1 and, you know, just, again, like, photography, and didn't realize what that would do for me as an adult, you know, and the influence that would have.
Yeah.
How's it been shooting for Duck and Whale? You've got a few stories in there, which is pretty awesome.
Yes.
And Sports Car Safari.
And Sports Car Safari. And that's where we originally met. Back in the day of the Victor Park event. Duck and Whale came about, for those of you that don't know, from the Sydney scene. So Lee Dean is the creator and editor of that. And he's based in Manly, which is where I used to live. So, yeah, Lee and I used to catch up together in the neighbourhood. And I first got involved with Duck and Whale actually as a subject of an article, and that was around Targa Tasmania that I did with another. So that was with a really good mate of mine, Jay McCormack. So Jay and I did Targa, and Lee interviewed us. So yeah, that was really how I first got involved in that. And you know, I was doing more and more photography, and the first assignment that I was given from Lee was the Bathurst 12-hour. So that was a fantastic event. And through Carby Tuckwell, he knew Patrick Long. Patrick Long is Luftigul. Carby was doing the artwork. So Patrick Long came out to race in the Bathurst 12-hour. You know, I got introduced, and it all came about, you know, like a lot of things in life, it's, you know, time and place and you know, just having the right access. And having the right access is, you know, just as important. Being able to sometimes talk your way into things, even if you're not, you know, fully skilled to deliver them, you need to talk the talk. So
a little bit of motivation.
Exactly. Before I knew it, I'd somehow convinced Patrick Long to do an interview with me. And, you know, I'm not a journalist. I'm not a professional photographer. And, you know, somehow at the event where he's racing, he decided he'd, you know, throw me a bone and go, all right, I'm going to agree to doing an interview. So I actually got my iPhone out and just started recording an interview. And I knew enough about Patrick Long to, you know, put together, you know, a pretty good, I wasn't completely sucky in asking stupid questions. I was able to, I knew what he was doing with Luftigult. I knew what he, I knew that he had a 964 like I did. So there were a few sort of tie-ins in there. And I actually had some really good access around the pit garage through the iced coffee, Icebreak coffee team, which was the team that he was racing for. So,
Binder in that team as well? Was he running it that year?
Chris Binder?
Yeah.
No, Matt Campbell.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right.
Matt Campbell was one of the drivers. Patrick Long was another one. And David Calvert-Jones, who was the team owner.
Mm.
But, yeah, so anyway, that all was a fantastic weekend. And Lee liked my photography. Lee liked my interview. And, yeah, we put it together and then it was printed. So there's nothing quite like, as an amateur photographer, there's nothing quite like seeing your photography turn into print and into, you know, a magazine that, you know, goes out and, you know, you can actually buy it from a news agency. So that was pretty cool. And that was my first, you know, paid gig as well. So, but that then led to, Andrew talked a little bit earlier around, you know, taking a camera on holidays. You know, that then led to, you know, my next holiday, which I did as a family holiday to Thailand. Now, for those of you that don't know, Thailand has got a really cool street and air-cooled scene.
Luke from Fuel seems to get over it a little bit, doesn't he?
Yeah. It's got a really eclectic mix of cars. You know, anything that's, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s is pretty cool there. So
even some Aussie stuff has made it over there too, I think, actually.
Well, because it's a right-hand drive market.
Yeah.
You get... you know,
stuff like that.
Yeah, there's all sorts of quirky stuff. And Indonesia is the other market, which gets quite a lot of old, you know, Aussie muscle cars appearing up there. But, I reached out to a couple of guys over Instagram and set up a meetup at my hotel, not really knowing what I was getting myself into. So at the time, I was just thinking I was meeting a guy by the name of Korn, he rocked up with would have been 15 of his closest Porsche mates early one Sunday morning to go for a bit of a cruise, and I sort of felt a little bit like royalty. The way that they treated me over there, it was so damn cool. They all went out of their way. They're very hospitable. There was a couple of guys that spoke English really well, whilst some of the others didn't. But they took me on a tour through downtown Bangkok and into old town of Bangkok early one Sunday morning, and that was a very memorable experience. I had my camera with me and I was shooting away and just got some really unique shots, through the city of Bangkok. But I did a follow-up interview with one of the guys, Korn, who's a very successful architect in Thailand, and he's got an amazing collection of Porsches, including some Beetles and Combis. So I did that interview via a translator. So that was very, very quirky. But that's where we both could speak just enough English to each other. We had both had so much passion for what we were talking about. The fact that we couldn't really understand each other didn't matter because it just all worked. So then turned into another photo shoot for Duck and Whale. So, had a lot of fun doing just sort of side projects like that, and that's all they are for me.
Yeah, I guess that's that creative outlet, isn't it? Like just another avenue to outside of daily life to do what inspires and what you enjoy.
Exactly. So you don't really make much of a buck these days out of photography because there's always someone willing to do it cheaper. It's just the kind of thing where when I started trying to chase dollars, it started to take a little bit of the shine off it. So I've slowed down with that kind of stuff now and just shoot for pleasure. And that's the kind of thing which I sort of like to concentrate on now is just things that, I get a little bit of pleasure out of. And, that's all it is for me right now is a side project.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is it, and it's interesting though. Like doing stuff and getting into print, I think is just it's one of those things that's like being able to have your work immortalized in paper is pretty cool. Like I think having we're so lucky with Instagram, like the connections we make with people around the world and the ease it allows us to communicate with each other and see what everything, what people have got going on. But I find you don't absorb it nearly as much as something that's in print or, that's permanent like that. Like it's too easy to just skip to the next thing.
Exactly. And, we're very much influenced by, an Instagram world at the moment. If you look at what works well in an Instagram photo, it will be a completely different photo experience once you print it. If you're shooting with good gear and you can blow it up and you've got decent resolution behind it, something which looks really ordinary on Instagram can absolutely pop when it's, turned into, a poster size photo that you'd hang on a wall. And that's the thing which, when you see, if you only look at your work on Instagram, you're missing out on the joy of photography. Once you see a photo blown up into, either magazine size or poster size, you can really see things that you just don't see, when you're looking at it on Instagram. And the amount of time that people spend, it's the old, you watch someone on Instagram, they're giving you might have spent half an hour trying to scope, and get the right photo, and you've potentially edited it and you've done all of these things to it, and you're doing it for an audience that's looking at it for a split second. And that's the crazy world that we live in today, where people can really, if they like it, they give it, a click and then they move on. And that's you kind of go, well, why am I doing all of this? which is what I used to do, daily. I used to post, twice a day. But then you kind of sort of after a while you stop and you go, it's a hell of a lot of work and it's a hell of a lot of commitment just to have people allocate, some split seconds on your work.
Yeah, and look, I think like definitely from my point of view where I'm putting the magazine together and trying to pick the layout of the the magazine and what photos go where and stuff. Stuff that doesn't work in the mag works perfectly on Instagram. Stuff that, you know, works on Instagram necessarily doesn't translate back to a good photo for a spread in a magazine.
Yeah.
And so what I'm finding is, like, as you're going through, you have 150 shots or 50 shots or whatever from a shoot, and immediately there's so many that you can just discount from putting into print just purely because of aspect or size, or, you know, even like the ability to create negative space with a photo and put it on Instagram is really hard. Like, to try and, you know, you're saying about blowing up pictures and having, you know, the detail that's inside of there. Yeah, to try and do like an image where there's a lot of nothing on Instagram is almost impossible. Like, it really needs to be quite a honed in image for the translation to come across. Whereas, you know, when you've got a magazine and you've got a double page spread and you can just throw something in the middle of it, it's perfect.
And that, for me, is there's so many photography done on Instagram where, you know, if I'm critiquing, you know, another photo that someone else has done, you know, like, the fun of photography is not there when you see someone that's just walked up, taken a photo of a car, where the car is 100% the subject. You know, I look at that now and I think, well, there's no skill involved in that. But I look at the engagement that particular photos, you know, get on those platforms, and it can be huge. And you kind of, as a photographer, you stop and you think, well, there's nothing actually creative or special about that photo. It's actually just a photo of a car, versus some of the other work. And, you know, one of my favorite photographers in car world right now is another good mate of mine, Thomas Walk. If you have a look at, you know, Thomas's photos, now he's editing and putting together the Type 7 book, which is now in second edition, that's about to come out. You know, if you look at it, his work in print, it's, you know, the car might be in the bottom right hand corner, but it's all about, you know, the drama of the photo, and you know, what the sun's doing or what the shadow lines are doing, and that what is in my books what makes a good photo. And that's you know, looking at photography from a physical hard book paper perspective versus, yeah, looking at the world through the lens of Instagram.
I do. I mean, and that's, I guess, one of the other things you talk about, reactions and stuff like that, that really is difficult, is like the whole like resharing of stuff. Like, I remember Instagram early on, I really enjoyed it for that photographic creation, artistic point of view, that like people put a lot of thought and effort into what was being shared. You know, it wasn't like Facebook or other things, we just threw up 40 photos at once and, you know, that was there. It was like, you know, everyone put a lot of effort into what they were doing. And it just frustrates me when you see like people and pages that are just based on like reposting other people's stuff.
Anyone who's a photographer, you know, just cringes when you see, you know, those pages, and you've just got to take a step back, because you can end up giving yourself an unnecessary ulcer, and if you take it all a bit too serious and go, oh, but I'm doing all of this different work, and, you know, how did this person, you know, when you're in that world of comparing. And at different stages of our life, that's been important, and I'll be happy to admit that, you know, I've gone through stages where I've, you know, chased followers, you know, and that's been, you know, my goal. But, you know, these days it's, I try and do things purely, you know, for a personal pleasure and a photography pleasure, rather than, you know, appeasing to the masses. And if you just need to remind yourself, you know, of what appealing to the masses is all about, you know, it's It's the, you know, do you want to eat McDonald's food? You know, do you want to eat food that's designed for the masses? Do they know what good is? Potentially not. You know, or do you want to go for something that's, you know, a little bit quirky and, you know, not everyone knows about? And that's sort of, I guess, the stage of life that I'm in. I try and do things, you know, that, yeah, it's not going to, and I don't want it to appeal to, you know, a huge audience, because that's, you know, not who I'm trying to associate with.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, that's also part of that finding your own style and your own little niche within that space, that, you know, not caring about everybody else really helps hone that, because you're not, you know, hell-bent on trying to get numbers and trying to get followers and trying to appeal to that person. You're doing your thing and letting people come to you, which is cool.
Exactly. So talking of magazines, I still do have the first edition of Sportscar Safari. You do owe me a couple of back catalogues, so we'll have to work something out.
I think I thought I sent them to you, but obviously not. I'll have to go through and do it.
Yeah. And when's the next edition likely to hit the streets?
Yeah, so Andrew and I are busily working on that now that he's come back from holidays. We've already got a few stories done. We've got to go shoot a few more and put it together. Look, we're looking on planning to have that one all done and ready for Adelaide Rally, which will be in November, which is pretty cool. So we're actually going to be sponsoring a stage at the rally and having a bit more of a presence alongside doing the usual photos and video packs that we have for competitors.
Fantastic.
That'd be pretty cool. Getting our name and brand out there a little bit more, and I guess helping support the event as it goes on, because you know, we've been very lucky to be able to keep working at it and being able to sell some stuff to it and sell some merch around that time and really help promote the brand. So we're planning on having the magazine ready and, you know, getting the magazine out to all the competitors and sponsoring a stay, which would be pretty cool. That'll be exciting.
Who would have thought a couple of years ago that that's where you'd be? So well done.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's cool. You know, it's a journey, and we're still learning as we go. And because Andrew and I both have never, you know, this is our first experience in print and doing this type of thing. It's an exciting journey. It's really cool. Hoping to continue, keep doing some stuff next year when we can get out of a lockdown. There's half a dozen stories I want to go shoot in Melbourne that I haven't been able to do yet. So they were going to be this year, but that's kind of put on the back burner at the moment.
And that's been, you know, well, obviously everyone's fallen into that category, and you know, without new content, which has actually forced, you know, a lot of people to sort of relook at what they've got and, you know, what's been archived. And gosh, I've gone back through, you know, some of my back catalogue of, you know, travels and adventures that I've done, and I've gone, why didn't I post that at the time? You know, it was such a brilliant photo. But then you kind of go, well, you know, I already posted, you know, 5 shots from that particular day. You know, there's sort of a limit as to how many you can do, but then you sort of forget about it and you move on, and you've got all of this great photography sitting there as shelfware.
Yeah. That's when I kind of wished that, like, Instagram had like no comments or no anything, like you just had to put something up with no explanation and let it do its own, you know, the photo does the explaining for you.
And that's what it used to be when it first first started. It was purely a photo sharing platform where you actually followed people that you didn't know. You followed people based on topics that you liked. And it was purely, and I remember back in the very early days, and I've been on Instagram for quite a while now. I think I started maybe 2011 or something along those lines. But and I had friends back in the early days go, oh, why aren't you following me? And I go, well,
I like what you're doing.
I'm friends with you, but I'm not interested in the photos that you're sharing. And it was pretty hard not to insult certain people that, you know, were like, oh, but, you know, we're good friends. And I'm like, yeah, but I'm following, let's just say, 400 people that I actually have never met, but I like what they're doing creatively. And that's what, you know, Instagram, you know, was for me back in the day. It was about, you know, following people that inspire you, that, you know, you like their content, rather than just the Facebook view, which is, you know, connecting with, you know, your 200 friends that, you know, you've built up over the years. So, yeah, it's just an interesting sort of lens of how over time it's now, it's very much turning into a bit more of, you know, a Facebook type feel rather than purely the photography. And if you really want to depress yourself, you know, you only have to read some of the comments that people, you know, the keyboard warriors, you know, say about each other. It's pretty heartbreaking.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. Yeah, you're trying to stay all that stuff and just do it. Yeah, like, because I was on Instagram from like 2011 as well, and yeah, I kind of miss the pre Facebook days.
Yeah, we all do.
We get there. Still, it's still a great platform, I think, for sharing, and much more preferred over other mediums at the moment. So,
yeah, indeed.
Although, yeah. Anyway.
Awesome.
I think that's a wrap.
I'm cool with that. Really enjoyed it. It's been great just to chew the fat, and hopefully some people have found it interesting as well.
Yeah, well, hopefully, you know, one of the things that I hope to do with this too is, like, I guess shed some light on the people behind what they might see. So not everyone, you know, you might have, you know, you've got what, close to, you know, got 9,000 followers. Not every one of those people can have an intimate conversation with you and find out who Nick is. So hopefully some people out there can see this and learn a little bit more about Nick, which is pretty cool. Yeah, speaking of, what was your Instagram handle again? It's
9 Alphas.
Nine Alphas. Actually, I can probably bring that up. But